Shall we, Charles, shall we kick off and say hello to everybody?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right. Well, welcome to those of us who've joined us already. My name is Adrian Harris. I'm talking today to Charles Eisenstein. He's down on the website as cultural philosopher, speaker and author. And I wanted to flag up, he's written several books, which are on his website. The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible is one that I particularly like, and we'll be touching into some of the ideas in there. And also Climate, A New Story, which again, we'll be touching into. So that's a very brief overview to some of the very rich life of and work of Charles. Charles, anything you wanted to add to that, or should we kick straight off?
Not really, except the title of the book is The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible.
Okay, what did I say?
I think you said More Peaceful World. But,
oh, okay.
Although I'd probably a more peaceful world would be much more beautiful as well.
So. That would be good too, eh? Yeah. Yeah, all right. So in that particular book, you were talking about the importance of stories and where the stories actually structure how we think of the world and how it makes sense of our whole existence. And this dominant story of separation, which has been around for, well, a long time now, and we really need this new story to come up. And this new story hasn't been written yet. We're in this sort of transitional phase. But I was curious as to whether you can see any clues about or threads about that new story. Are there any thinkers or movements who are speaking about this new story?
Well, I think that the new story is arising all around us and within us as well. Maybe I'll just quickly summarize the story of separation, which is really more of a mythology than a story that tells us who we are, why we're here, what's real, what's possible, how the world is, how to live life. Uh-huh. All of these are these questions are answered in different ways in different cultures. And our culture has said implicitly or even explicitly, who you are is a separate individual in a world that is other, a world that is separate from itself, and that does not itself have the qualities of a full being, a full subject. So we're kind of humans are alone in the world, and our well-being depends on exercising greater and greater control and domination over the random forces of nature and over the other competing beings out there. Another part of this story of separation, which is related to the theme of your course, is the separation of mind and body, or the separation of spirit and matter, that has stripped sacredness from the world and from the body and deposited it in a supernatural or divine realm that is spiritual as opposed to material. So part of a new story would be the reunion of these separated polar opposites. Okay. So a reunion of spirit and matter, a reunion of mind and body, a reunion of heart and mind, you could say, a recovery of community, which is a reunion with each other, reunion of human and nature. Like all of these divisions are wanting to come back together again. And so a new story, like use the word interbeing for the new story, which I believe originated with Thich Nhat Hanh. A new story is anything that speaks of and speaks to and contributes to these various areas of reunion. So that's kind of the big picture of it.
Okay, that's useful. Thank you. Yeah, so you flagged up quite a few different areas where these things are beginning to to come together. And it's sort of overcoming this dualism that we've had for such a long time. And embodiment is quite central to that, potentially, that bringing together of the mind and body. So is that something that you could speak a little about, that relationship between how embodiment enables that kind of coming together?
Well, I mean, I could say that the story of separation says that your actual self is the mind, or is the consciousness that is carried in the body as in a vehicle. Mm-hmm. Or if you're religious, it would say that your actual self is the soul, and the body is just the envelope for the soul. So religion and philosophy, science, they all concur on what the actual self is. Religious teachings that say you are not your body, for example, that they participate in this in this separation. And that doesn't, so these teachings have a certain appeal when matter and the body have been reduced to mere automatons. Then our sense that there is a sacredness and a coherence and an innate intelligence in all things finds expression through spiritual ideologies. But I think what we really want to do is to re-embrace matter as itself having the qualities that have been exported onto spirit, and to embrace the body as having these qualities that we've exported onto spirit or exported onto mind. And this is, you know, coming into science now too, where we understand that cognition and everything that we call the mind isn't just like some separate program running on the wetware of the brain, but it is a bodily function. That, you know, our peptides and our neurotransmitters and our nervous system is not just in the brain, but has the participation of every system in the body, that our full being is a biological function, and that the body, and I'll just add this one last thing to say that, yeah, actually right now you are just your body. That does not reduce you to this deterministic physiological flesh robot. Mm-hmm. Because we are bringing back spiritual qualities into matter. And we understand that consciousness, for example, exists in matter, in everything. Mm-hmm. Just as indigenous people believed in not just humans and not just animals, but also trees and soil. Is mm-hmm. conscious, and water is conscious and intelligent and alive. This is profoundly unscientific in the science that we have been immersed in for a long time, but most people on Earth have always believed this. And now in science, now there are trends that are leading us back to a fully animated, fully alive, fully intelligent, conscious universe.
Yeah, that's a really exciting development. So we're coming back into a much more animist way of being, much more animist way of seeing the world.
Yeah, and that's what I mean by interbeing, like to say that who you are not a separate self in a world of other. You are the totality of your relationships. You are an interconnected being. It's not only that your mind and your consciousness are a body function, not just a brain function, but it's also a relational function.
Yeah.
Which is why when a relationship in your life ceases to exist, that you feel an existential loss. Like this person was part of you. And when they're gone, who you are is no longer the same. Mm. And on a larger level, I think even ecologically, when a species goes extinct, or when your favorite forest has been cut down, there's a loss that, and a sadness and a pain that you can't explain away through the self-interested calculations of a separate self that says, well, now my interests you know, because this estuary has been poisoned with toxic waste, now I'm going to suffer some, rational self-interested loss. It's like, I loved those beings. They were part of me. We've been feeling, I just recently moved with my wife to Rhode Island, probably just for a few months. This is where she grew up. And yeah, we were like out by the shore and there were these tidal pools. And she said, you know, when I was a kid, these tidal pools were full of life. There were shellfish and sea anemones and even like little fish in there and all kinds of plants. And now they're basically just occasionally, maybe you see like a hermit crab or something like that, but they used to be full of life. And she said, yeah, on that beach there, people would go clamming. You could find, you could get buckets full of clams and no more. And like, there's a sadness there, a loss that is available to us as we accept that we are part of the world and the world is part of us. And we're not just inhabiting it and using it as a instrument for our own ends.
That's really useful, and that leads me on to one of the things you said in your book about climate change, when you were saying, can we change the narrative from that kind of very scientific, fear-driven to a different way of looking at it, where we're connecting with the love that we're feeling for the earth. We're connecting right. with the empathy that we feel.
Right. One of the things that I say in the book is that the narrative of we better take care of earth, protect the environment, because if we don't, bad things will happen to us. I think that mindset of because bad things will happen to us is part of the problem. To see the value of the world, the value of nature, the value of forests and wetlands and fish and whales, solely in terms of what they can do for us, that is the mindset of separation. That is the mindset of putting everything into service to human beings. And I'm advocating a participatory mindset where acknowledging that we love all of the beings that surround us. We say, what is in service to all of life? How can we as humans be in service to all of life? Knowing that the thriving of life will also create conditions for the thriving of humanity, that it's not a war of each against all. That's not what ecology is. That's not what life is. But in fact, life maintains the conditions for life to thrive. That we will be healthier, happier, more fulfilled, and more abundant when life on Earth is more abundant. So that adds, it expands the purview of, say, the climate movement to encompass much more, a much higher priority on conservation, it's already recognized in the climate movement that it's important to save the Amazon, the rainforests, and so on. But when we understand them as more than just protect them in case of bad, so that a bad thing won't happen to us, but as beings in their own right that contribute to the totality of life that we want to participate in, then our emphasis goes even more to those things. So the controversial part of my book is that I'm saying we need to put top priority on rainforest conservation, whale conservation, wetlands conservation and restoration of soil regeneration, regenerative agriculture, for example, to protect the organs and tissues of a living planet. And cutting greenhouse gases is important, but not the first priority. But in any case, it'll happen anyway when we say, well, we're not going to dig tar sands. That destroys the forest. And we're not going to do offshore oil drilling. The spills poison marine wildlife. and so on and so forth. So there's actually a convergence of goals between what I'm saying and what the mainstream movement is saying. I'm not sure how deeply I want to go into this, but just to summarize, it is a shift in mindset from what will happen to us if we don't, to what do we serve here? What do we serve as beings on this earth? And the service comes from love.
Okay, that's a beautiful way of putting it. Just pulling out an earlier phrase, you said that our being is about the totality of our relationships, which is really the core of what you're saying there.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
There's quite often when I'm reading your work, it sounds like there's some parallels with deep ecology. Is that a philosophical field or movement that you have an accord with?
Well, I like the poetics of deep ecology. It sounds like something I resonate with. I'm never actually quite sure what deep ecology is. I mean, I guess it would be the broader and deeper application of ecological thinking, which is about relationships. So yeah, I'm not qualified to really philosophize on, I'm not that familiar with what, you know, with what philosophers who call themselves deep ecologists are actually saying and the different schools of thought in it. I'm not an expert on that.
Okay. That's let's put that on one side. There's quite a lot in what you're saying about our spiritual relationship to the world. And I think it's pretty safe to say we both have a connection between spirituality and activism. Is that something you could unpack a little bit for us?
Yeah. So when the dualism between spirit and matter dissolves, then the dualism between spirituality and activism dissolves as well. For one thing, our understanding of how to change the world expands, and traditional activism, which often is about making change happen, forcing something to change, fighting something, a campaign against something, it's very often uses military metaphors. It's a struggle, a fight, a campaign, a battle. That we can reconceive that. And for example, we understand that the things that we're seeing in the world mirror conflicts that are happening within ourselves and conflicts that are happening within our activist groups. And that that the effectiveness of our activism can be destroyed or seriously impaired by our internal divisions. So that this idea that, well, we have to, it would be nice to work on our group harmony and work on all this stuff, but there's, you know, a world to save, so we'll do that later. We're beginning to understand that our internal coherence is crucial to us being effective as change agents in the world. And that also doesn't, and the other way goes too. Like, you can't say, well, okay, we're not going to do anything in the world till we build our group coherence and our internal spiritual purity. And then we'll go out and change the world. So first change ourselves, then change the world. Because how do we even generate the grist for the mill to do spiritual work or to do group coherency work? It comes through the challenges and conflicts that we encounter in our relationship to the outside world. That's what brings up the issues. So if you're all just sitting in a nice little group, there's not anything to fight about. Well, actually, usually we do find things to fight about. But you know, when it comes to, okay, how are we going to make decisions together? That's what brings up the controversy. So I think that people are understanding that inner work, you know, I would say it's on three levels. There's inner work, the relational work, and then the work out in the world. Like these three have to all go together, and each one informs the other ones.
So again, it's that bringing together, it's overcoming the dualities again. It's once again, it's bringing together the two, isn't it? In the same way that you have throughout, overcoming that separation.
Yeah. And then there's also the one more element I would put into there when talking about spirituality and activism is, so again, like in the beginning, I mentioned that we have exported into the category of spiritual things that do not fit into the material account of causality as we have known it. In other words, that says, here is how change happens in the world. Our dominant paradigm of how change happens in the world is essentially Newtonian mechanics. You make a change happening by exerting a force on a mass. And if you don't exert a force, then nothing changes. That is Newtonian mechanics. Things don't just happen unless something makes them happen. So if we want to change the world, we have to make it happen by exerting some kind of force. Now, you're just one person, so you're not going to be able to exert much force on your own. You have to accumulate a lot of money, a lot of hierarchical power, because then you can make people do things. You can pay them to do things that their self-interested selves wouldn't ordinarily want to do. Or maybe you can get a big platform, a big audience, a big mailing list, lots of Facebook followers. Then you can make a real difference. That's the Newtonian thinking, that it comes from a very limited understanding of causality, of how change happens in the world. That begins to shift as we understand what the story of interbeing, that says we're all related, what that says about causality. Because if you're not really separate from the world, if every person in the world mirrors something in yourself, if every relationship you have tells something about yourself, if everything happening on the planet is in some way happening to you, if, to use Rupert Sheldrake's terminology, if every act of generosity or kindness or courage generates a field of generosity, kindness, and courage that allows the same thing to happen more easily elsewhere, that's morphic resonance, then our formula for how to make change happen, we can see it's very narrow. And what counts as activism broadens. So I think that, to take it back to story, I think that given that the world runs on a set of stories, at the root of which is the story of separation, but it extends to the story that we call government, the story that we call money, the story that we call education, medicine, science, technology. These are infused with our narratives. When we understand that the world, the social world at least, is built on story, then as activists, as change agents, we need to be conscious of what story are we contributing to with our words and actions? And how can we disrupt the story of separation that is generating, the story of racism, the story of national borders, like all the stories that perpetuate the world-destroying machine. Maybe we can disrupt those. Maybe we can offer alternatives to those as they break down. So our activism then takes on a character that starts to look pretty spiritual.
I sometimes find people who, they sort of set activism apart in exactly the way that you're saying. They said, oh, they're activists over there. I can't be an activist. I'm not, whatever. But you're really subverting that and saying, no, everybody, I'm hearing you saying everybody can be an activist in their own particular way and make a difference, whatever it is they're doing.
Yeah, that's right. The question then becomes, what is my call to service? So even to take climate change as an example, normally speaking, a climate change activist would be somebody who's out there in the streets. I think there's something in London now to try to shut down the city as a protest against climate change and to demand the government do something about it. Like, that is one level of activism. But what if we try to, what if we ask, okay, where is consumer culture coming from? Why are we addicted to economic growth? Or if we're addicted to fossil fuels and we take the addiction metaphor seriously, where is that addiction coming from? What need is it trying to serve that is unmet? What need is addiction to alcohol in an individual or to shopping or to gambling or to pornography? What need does that meet? Does that meet that's unmet? Is it a need for connection? Is it a need for meaning? Is the person overeating because they're lonely? Or is it because they're just an addict and they're bad and we have to keep it away from them? So applying that on a collective level too, what are the unmet needs? What is the poverty that is driving endless consumption and endless waste? That, you know, the consumption and waste of our society. What? Because it's not actually making everybody happier. That would be one thing if this society was working so well that we were in such a state of joy and light all the time, and maybe nature has to pay the price for that. Like, then you, maybe you could argue that, okay, this is working here. But I mean, just look at the statistics for depression and suicide and so forth in the most advanced countries. Like, and go to some third world country, even where people are materially very poor. Like, it's like, wow, I've never seen people so happy. I've spoken to so many travelers, you know, coming back from places that are less touched by development. And one of the things that they almost always report on, unless there's like actual war going on, but even sometimes in refugee camps, like the amount of joy that people have access to. So to bring it back to the question, what are the ground conditions that give rise to the world-destroying machine? And maybe your activism works with those ground conditions, which make it invisible in traditional terms. Like, say your work is to rehabilitate homeless people. From a carbon metrics perspective, it's really hard to say that you're doing any good at all to forestall runaway climate change. Because in fact, you could even argue that you're making things worse, because homeless people are scavengers. Their carbon footprint is nearly zero. And if you're bringing them back into society and maybe they find a job and they have an apartment now, and now they become producing and consuming members of society. So Ebenezer Scrooge says, well, you're making the problem worse. It'd be better for the planet if they stay homeless, or if they die, solve the population problem. Like, that kind of quantitative thinking is, again, something I think is part of the problem. So when we understand, though, that in the story of interbeing, that a society that doesn't take care of its most vulnerable members will inevitably be a society that doesn't take care of its most vulnerable places and most vulnerable species, then you understand that all forms of healing, personal, social, political, and ecological, are part of the same healing. And then you have license to listen to what calls to your care. And it is that call to your care that deploys you where you are most needed, where the intelligence of all things, the planetary intelligence, which again, in the story of separation, is a ridiculous concept. But when we no longer restrict full beingness to human beings, then we can entertain the idea of a planetary intelligence. It wants to heal. So when you make yourself available, it will call through the organ of the heart to your care and deploy you where your gifts meet the needs, and you will feel that you are in service. You will feel that you are participating in a healing. And I just offer to trust that guidance system, even if the mind cannot justify it in terms of carbon accountancy.
It strikes me you're talking about a heartfelt calling to care, which is very, it's like an embodied wisdom, isn't it, that you're talking?
Yeah. Yeah, you could say it's an embodied wisdom or an embodied orienting system, because we are living at a time when our minds, our understanding of the way the world works is disintegrating. In politics, for example, these political events are happening that are very disturbing. And people are like grasping for explanations. I mean, in Brazil, what's been happening is really disturbing to me. I mean, I'm much more disturbed by that even than by Trump or Brexit, as far as the immediate damage that could happen. But, you know, with Trump or with Brexit, people are grasping to make sense of it. So here we had this whole Russiagate thing, you know, like this, which is basically an attempt to explain it in familiar us versus them concepts, rather than seeing it as a symptom of a deep breakdown. So the mind does not understand what's happening and does not understand how to do anything about it. Under those circumstances, we need to orient in some other way. And one way to look at that is to reintegrate the excluded parts of the mind, because remember, we were saying the mind and the body are not really separate. Like, we have other faculties besides the cognitive, analytical, quantitative faculties that we can rely on, the intuition of the body, the heart, the gut, the cells, the bones, that include the cognition, but they are not limited to that. And at this time of intellectual disintegration and a crisis in our meaning making, these other faculties become even more important than they would ordinarily be. If we have a healthy story, a robust story that is resonant with who we want to be, and that is broadly accepted in society, then the mind becomes more useful. We can rely on that a lot more than we can in the current time.
So there's a sense that sort of rational thinking in the mind is valuable, but it's all got horribly out of balance, and it's just cut out any connection with those much more embodied intuitive sensitivities.
Yeah, I think, like, I'm definitely not, I mean, look at me, I'm, you know, an intellectual person. I'm not, and I'm using mental concepts right now. So I'm not wanting to discard the mental faculties. But they are insufficient to the crisis at hand. That's all. And maybe part of this will be to understand what the appropriate domain of the mind is and how it functions within a larger physiological and cultural whole. So that would be, you know, an interesting philosophical conversation that we could have. So, but yeah, I'm not discarding the mind by any means.
It seems to speak to that broader sense of bringing things together, to overcoming duality and coming into this new story that we're working towards.
I'm not sure if I would look at it in terms of overcoming duality, but perhaps just to recognize that these dualities are breaking down, and to and to recognize our own discomfort with them. I think it's an organic process that is underway. That is the breakdown of not just dualities, but many of our categories, the boxes that we're putting the world into, they and ourselves. I mean, this is another component of the whole story, the story of self. Who am I? How do I live a life? The formulas that we were given don't work very well anymore of how to do this thing called human. So we have to then, we don't even want to say this is what's happening. I'm just directing attention onto what's happening. The breakdown of our categories, including the dualistic ones, but other ones too. The breakdown of these stories, bringing us to a point of, I don't know. I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to change the world. I don't know how to live my life. I don't know how to be human. I don't know. And at least, and when I say I don't know, that goes along with, yes, on a level, I do know. But that level of I do know becomes available only through the level of I don't know, which is a breakdown in our conceptual categories and our narrative forms of understanding. So the I don't know is another word for that is humility. And it is a vast improvement on I do know when you don't actually know. Like thinking that you know, but actually not knowing, you're just going to replicate the same mistakes again and again. It's when you acknowledge that wasn't working and I don't know after all how to do this thing. That would be a major positive step forward. I would love to see a politician say, you know, I don't have a plan for healthcare or for the economy for that matter. And I don't know what to do about immigration. And not sure about climate change, what to do about that either. Poverty, don't know. Like that would be refreshing to have someone admit that he or she doesn't know what to do, because that is when the creativity can come in. Because there are people out there who do know, like they're on the margins, just as there are parts of ourselves that we've marginalized in our story of separation that do know what to do, that do know how to live life. So there are, in on the political level, on collective level, there are also marginalized parts of the body politic that do know how to solve the problem of crime or how to address it with restorative justice and restorative circles and truth and reconciliation committees and things like that. There are people who know how to address the ecological crisis with regenerative agriculture and ecosystem healing and soil healing and water healing. There are people who know how to, I mean, all of these, in the health realm as well, like everything that we've marginalized and called alternative and holistic and pushed it out, that's what comes rushing into the center when the vacuum of humility is present.
That's a very powerful phrase, the vacuum of humility, and it allows all this to come in. There's a real sense there of us needing, in this very transitional space, of us needing to surrender, to let go and be open to what's going to come next.
Yeah. Yes, and I would say that this surrender is underway and includes even our efforts to resist it. Surrender is also not something that you can do as a formula.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not something you can kind of decide to do. It's just the kind of, it's almost a mindful release.
Right. And this, you know, gets to a more spiritual level of all of this, where it's not about making yourself change in some way. The mindset of Newtonian force has been applied to spirituality and transformation and so on as well. So an alternative would be to use your faculty of attention and give attention to what wants to happen, to give attention to your willingness to change. to give attention to the breakdown of your stories, to give attention to your feeling of desperation, to give attention to that germ of hope that has been awakened in you when you have experienced, even temporarily, a different self and a different world and a different level of human relating, to give attention to all of those things. That can feed the process of transformation without making it happen, without it turning into yet another battle that you have to win, this one against some part of yourself.
Great. So that's the core thing. It's just focusing your attention in a different way and in a different place, different direction, and then let that come.
And then trust that actions will come from that. Changes come from that and different choices come from that. And the same thing is true on a social, political level. Like when the invisible is brought into consciousness, change happens. When I recently met a man who does gender healing work, and he brings men and women together in these safe containers. And women, one of the things that he does is women tell their stories of being abused, of being raped, of being assaulted, of being violated. And he creates conditions where the men really, really listen and really go into, wow, what was it like for that to happen? And he says, no man walks out of that unchanged. And their behavior radically transforms. It's not because they were made afraid to do that again. It's because new data points came in. Things that had been excluded from their seeing and from their feeling were let in. And that generates changes that are way more powerful than what happens through, you know, education, in quotation marks here.
Is there that's a powerful story. I'm wondering whether there's a model in that for the greater transformation that's coming.
Yeah, to generalize that, it is to create conditions where what had been unseen and unheard, unwitnessed, can come into consciousness. And in our political environment today, which is so highly polarized, it's challenging to do that. Because anything that you present, people are going to be like, okay, so what are you trying to accomplish with this? Which narrative are you serving? Is this going to be an example of why we should do X, Y, and Z, why we should build a border wall? Or is this going to be an example of why Trump is terrible and why we shouldn't build a border wall? Like people, the first thing that people are asking when you say anything in a political climate is, which side are you on? So when that's the first question, then you will become unable to hear because you'll be listening for that. So I think if we want a deeper healing that doesn't depend on team good winning over team evil, which is most people's formula for a better society today, team good finally defeats team evil. That has not worked. Everyone thinks that they're on team good. That's the first thing to understand. It's like whoever you're opposed to, I don't know, you guys are in the UK, right? If it's UKIP, like that, do you think that they're like sitting around hatching evil plots and saying to each other? No, they think they're full of righteousness. They think that they're helping the world. Everyone thinks they're on team good. So if you want a deeper level of change that doesn't depend on overcoming team evil, then you have to create conditions where people can hear their stories. Like, I'm sure that if the Republicans in this country, and unfortunately, a lot of the Democrats are in league with the anti-immigrant policies. I mean, Obama deported a lot of people too. But I feel like if they could really hear the story of, you know, a Guatemalan refugee who is taking tremendous risks and couldn't feed her child. And I mean, if they could actually hear the real human stories, the entire political discourse around it would change. So how do we create conditions where people can see each other, really? and what gets in the way of that. And so again, we're getting to a spiritual level of activism. The habit of judgment, I think, is a key barrier to being able to understand what it's like to be another person. Judgment being, if I were you, I wouldn't have done such a thing. Why? Well, I'm better than that. I'm better than they are. As long as you think you're better than somebody, you're not going to be able to understand them, because you're going to have this overlay of judgment. So this is getting into what you call spiritual territory. And I think that it, when we can cast aside judgments or see past them or through them, it's not like we become just nicer people and let the evildoers have a free ride, a free pass. It's that we become more effective at addressing the actual causes of the things that are hurting us so much. The racism, the bigotry, the ecological destruction. We are able to see to the real causes instead of the shibboleth of evil people. As long as we blame the problem on evil, we will never solve the problem. That's my opinion, and I understand that it's a very long and multidimensional conversation, so I apologize to anyone listening who feels that I've trivialized important issues. But I'm just kind of setting this pole down, or planting the seed or offering a lens to look at the world through that might be useful and might reveal things that could get us unstuck.
I think that's a really useful perspective that you brought in there. We've got another few minutes before we finish, and I wanted to just ask if there's anything that's inspiring you right now. Is there a thinker, an embodied practice, or a political movement that's really exciting you at the moment?
Well, I like a lot of many. I'm hesitant even to like name some just because of the ones that implicitly excludes. I like a lot of the land-based people's movements in Central America, for example, South America, India, Canada, the practices of regenerating soil, healing land and healing water, restoring water systems. Those are really inspiring to me. I'm not going to say that like one has been in a special influence. I'm curious, do you have any questions from listeners here? I keep seeing the chat box light up. Or is that just too much to even go into now?
I'm just having a quick scan through there. There's quite a lot of discussions there, picking up on things you've said about love as a perception. I'm really, really agreeing with a lot of the things that you're saying, that compassion comes from deep listening. I guess you've been following some of those in there.
I haven't been focused on what's been happening in the chat. Okay. Anyway, I'm happy to speak on anything else that is coming up for you, whether or not it's in the chat.
We've got about another 5 minutes or so. Is there anything that you feel we haven't covered? Anything that you particularly wanted to sort of round off with, a way of summing up your vision or the way that you see things?
Well, there's many, many things I could say. I just came off a 5-day retreat where we went deep, deep, deep into the transition from the story of separation to the story of interbeing. Maybe one thing is that this is so much more than a paradigm shift, a substitution of one conceptual framework for understanding the world with another one. Because these stories, and this is true of any belief system, actually, or any even belief that someone might hold, These are just one layer of something much bigger. The conceptual layer, the story layer, is part of a holistic state of being. So when someone transitions from one belief system to another, that coincides with a change in their being, and often a change in their relationships, a change in their work, a change in their bodies, change in their health. It's not just that you change your mind. So when we think in terms of how do we change people's minds, that is not a deep enough question. It has to go along with how do we change people's experience of life? When their experience of life changes, then their minds will change. Their beliefs will change. When we understand this, we're not going to waste time by trying to, with brute force, change someone's mind. We think that if we could only present strong enough logic and strong enough evidence, then we could make someone's mind change. That's again a paradigm of force. It's the Newtonian paradigm. And you've probably experienced, most people have probably experienced the futility of that. You argue with your drunk uncle on the holidays and you present all of the evidence, and he doesn't even accept the evidence. He's like, well, where did you read that? And the logic doesn't influence him. And he leaves the conversation even more convinced of his position coming into it. Plus, you're an idiot. That's what he'll think. You just don't get this, you don't get that, you know, you're naive, et cetera, et cetera. So those interactions don't work. And we have to then understand that the beliefs are a symptom almost, a symptom of a whole experience of life. And then the question becomes, how do we change that person's experience of life? How do we participate in the transformation or the evolution of their state of being? How do we feed who they want to become? Sometimes that might involve offering them a different story on a conceptual level, when it's not only a symptom. It's mostly a symptom, but it's also part of a larger thing. So when that change is already underway, when they're no longer comfortable in who they have been, then they're ready for new beliefs. They're open for new ideas, and you can feed those, and that might contribute to the metamorphosis that's happening. So it's not like that, you know, because I'm actually offering a different story right now. So I don't think that what I'm doing is useless, but I'm also aware that I am communicating on another level, not just a semantic level. That I'm communicating with my voice, with my energy, with my being, and that that those things might actually be more powerful than the content of what I'm saying. Might be. So I guess that's what I'll end with, just to say that we must understand that it's more than a paradigm shift. Everything is changing.
Looks like Adrian has frozen up right at the end there. So let me say thank you so much for joining us today. That was deep, profound, touching, sparked all kinds of conversations for us here. You liked it too?
Yeah, I loved it, yeah.
So, really appreciate it. In terms of finding out more about your stuff, I'm going to personally recommend your online courses, which are all donation-based, as I understand it, as well.
I'm actually launching a new one really soon.
Plug it, please.
Shameless plug. It's called Living in the Gift, and it is, again, about not just how, you know, how to interface with the money economy, but also a way of seeing and perceiving self and world through the lens of gift.
So, thank you. Yeah. And Charles's this recording will be available free for a week. It's one of the ones that's not on the paid package, which is Charles's choice, and I totally respect that. So really okay. And just want to let people know that in case they were, you know, particularly like this one. You can still listen to it again, though, for a week on the website. So absolutely free there. Charles's course, I did his one on food. And I've come across a lot of psychologists and different people. And I was like, yeah, okay. Five people recommended it, so I did it. And I was like, no, it was really profound and very accessible as well. So, that was the put. I was like, let's get him on the conference. I was really keen. So, Charles, thank you so much for joining us today. Daniela, can you put a link to Charles's website up so people can find out that? As you were talking about separateness, I was really touched by it. Sort of profoundly grateful that we can all connect online and simultaneously profoundly sad that so many of us were on our own. So I was looking through the boxes on the, and I was realizing there's only, is it Hannah and Mansour? There's only you guys and us two here. Made a new friend. And a couple of people with cats and a couple of people with babies. And I saw one person with their dog. I love seeing life happening on the screen. So don't be ashamed, guys, to have your cameras on. Like if life is going on at your house, you know, it's okay if you're beating your children. No, it's okay if you're just living and there's things happening and you have to text someone and you're making the dinner. That's life. That's what this is all about. So don't feel like you have to be sat there rigidly on your own. And I really would invite you to invite someone to watch one of the other calls with in the next day or two. Invite an old friend over, drag your partner involved, you know, put on the Facebook group and see if someone has your interests in your area. Stuart is able to sort of group people together by geography. So I love online connection, and there's no substitute for getting together, and we're going to cook some food in a minute before the next call and that kind of thing as well. So I just want to encourage that. Daniela, can you put the link up to our charity? So we're supporting LGBTQ Russia, who have some particular difficulties and stresses, as many of you know. We're offering, if anyone feels inclined to give to that group and their work with stress, leadership and trauma, then please do. Okay, we have an hour's break. There's the normal, what we call coffee break, which means for the next 15 minutes, you have the option of going into a group to discuss amongst yourself. That can be one of the things that's missing from an online event with all the speakers, is actually a chance to just chat about it and process and meet some other human beings. So hang around if you want to do that. If not, please hang up. That way you won't be put in a group with other people. So the next call is in an hour's time, and I believe it's with Arowana Hayashi. Is that right, Daniela? Yeah, so Arowana is an expert in what's called social presencing and leadership work that's very profound. I think she's a real elder in this work, so I recommend Arowana. And then Brooke McNamara, who's our local poet. She's the events poet and also a Zen teacher and a dancer. She describes herself as a poet and Zen mama. That's how she describes herself. Brooke is wonderful if you caught her last night. And she's on late at night at, is it 10 o'clock UK time or midnight? Let me double check that. Yeah, she's on at 10 o'clock UK time, 11 o'clock CET. So catch Brooke if you want some delight there. Okay. So, Daniela, can you put people in breakout groups of, let's say, six, because there's usually a couple of people that aren't around. And that's it for now. Thank you.
I'll just leave it a minute for people that want
to. Okay, cool.
And then I can see the numbers going down. And when they even out, we'll get some breakout rooms going.
Is Charles headed off, or is he still here? I can't see him.
Can't see him either.
Okay, I think you said it off. So thank you, Charles.